The result was an extraordinary flourishing of art, architecture, science, and learning.
The Normans continues tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on BBC Two.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 9:30. And now, after the premiere of his violin concerto in tonight's Prom, composer Hugh Watkins talks to Andrew McGregor in the second of this year's Prom's Composer Portraits.
Welcome to the Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music, just behind the Royal Albert Hall in London, where in today's Composer Portrait we're going to hear piano pieces and chamber music by Hugh Watkins, played by the composer with students from the Royal College of Music, where Hugh's now a professor of composition. And we'll be finding out from the man himself something about the ideas behind the pieces and the process of composition for him. We're going to begin with Gig. It's a piece Hugh wrote for the Nash Ensemble's 40th birthday season in 2005. It's a short title, but there is quite a bit of wordplay involved in it on gigue, that's a Baroque dance movement in 6/8, and, well, gig, musicians' slang for a performance. To play it, please welcome our first performers from the Royal College of Music, conducted by the composer Hugh Watkins.
Thank you.
Gig by Hugh Watkins, performed for us here in the Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music by some of its students, flautist Nicola Crowe, clarinetist Jessica Grimes, harpist Mally Lewis, violinist Yuka Matsumoto and Agata Policzynska-Maloko, viola player Edmund Smith and cellist Frédéric Legrand, following in the footsteps of the Nash Ensemble, who commissioned the piece and gave the first performance. And Hugh, you and the Nash are old friends, aren't you? Because didn't they give you one of your first public successes with Sonata?
That's right. Over 10 years ago now, in fact, it was Faber Music, really, that commissioned a series of pieces for the Millennium, and mine was placed very happily with the Nash Ensemble. My brother is the cellist, Paul, of the Nash Ensemble, so I wrote a sort of mini concerto for him.
And having a sort of close relationship through Paul and with a group like the Nash, it can become something of a test bed for chamber music, can't it, if you get the right opportunities? How useful has it been?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's always lovely to write for the Nash Ensemble because they're not only brilliant soloists, all of them actually, but the blend, they play together so much, it comes second nature to them to playing very complicated new scores.
And something like Gig, like the piece we've just heard, as a commissioner, do you get the choice of the instrumentation, or is that given to you as part of the deal?
It varies. Sometimes Amelia, who's the boss, has ideas, and sometimes she gives you a certain amount of flexibility. I think I really wanted to... There's the wonderful Ravel piece for this same combination. I think she wanted several pieces for that combination to go alongside it. And so that's how that particular thing came about.
Now, let's not talk about the processes for just a moment, because I was curious about something in the biographical notes that you have in the programme for this evening's prom and the violin concerto. It has that... Well, it's almost a bland line. He began composing at an early age, which says sort of everything and nothing, because most of us, no matter how musical, don't. So... How did it begin for you?
I can't remember. You have to ask my parents. I think there was just a lot of manuscript paper around the house, and I like to fill it up.
How much has changed since then?
Well, I don't know.
How long was it before you actually started thinking, I need to get some form into this, I'm getting some really interesting ideas, and this is something more than just something to pass the time away of actually playing with the dots?
I mean, I think it wasn't until my later teenage years that I really started taking it seriously. I mean, up until then, it was an enjoyable pastime, and I didn't quite realise the power that a piece of music could have before that, and how much hard work actually... one needs to put in. It's not just a kind of... You want to express something and you write some notes down. There's a lot of craft as well, I feel.
And how much of that is dependent on getting the feedback of performers? Because obviously that's one of the hardest aspects of beginning a journey as a composer, is getting the things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's strange that there are so many composers now who aren't performers. It was the norm for the whole of musical history. And it's changed somewhat. Of course, there are very notable exceptions, but for me, certainly, I couldn't not perform. The feedback that you get from playing live to an audience is nothing can compare with that.
And there must have been a point of no return when you realised that actually either you needed to really do something with this or that there was an opportunity for you to do it. What happened? When did that come?
Probably in this very building, actually. After my time at university, I did a postgrad year here. And it's a wonderful place. It still is. Amazing students, as we've heard, and we'll hear again. I just loved being in this environment in London, and I realised that was... Yeah, I absolutely wanted to be a composer. I mean, I suppose I'd realised before, but coming here absolutely made my mind up.
And you often write piano parts for yourself to play. Does that change the nature of the deal you have as a composer of a work?
Well, it could do, couldn't it? I suppose one could write something very easy.
That'd be no fun at all.
But that would be no fun. No, of course, you try to write for your strengths. And I've got quite big hands. I know other pianists often complain. I can stretch a tenth quite easily. And not everybody can, actually. So, I mean, I don't know, probably composing, I like the sound of tenths. And I can't stop myself writing them, I'm afraid.
So you're not necessarily writing within your easiest compass. You'd like to challenge yourself, even if it's something you have to play.
Oh, absolutely, yes, particularly if it's a solo piece, yes.
Well, we're going to hear one. We're going to hear four inventions for solo piano, first performed just last summer at the Cheltenham Festival.
Yes, just a year ago.
Yeah, and the dedication and title make this feel like a pretty personal piece, commissioned by Rhett Griffiths for his beloved sister Sarah.
It was a lovely thing to do. Rhett is a good friend of mine who wanted to do something slightly different for his sister's birthday. So he wrote a poem and asked me if I'd somehow write a piece of music that was inspired by it. His poem was called The Sibling Solution. So, I know what it's like to have a sibling too, and I actually the piece is kind of abstract, but his sister's a sort of amateur pianist, he wanted something that she could have a go at, so I took this idea of Bach two-part inventions, thought, can I write some two-part inventions myself, something that's... And there's a nice connection, sort of sibling rivalry between hands and what have you. And and then the piece went off in its own direction. But I think each of the four pieces have quite distinctive and contrasting characters.
And they've just got a single word instruction at the head of each one. Declamatory, hesitant, breathless, and serene.
Yes.
Shall we hear them?
Okay.
Hugh Watkins is going to perform Four Inventions.
Thank you.
four inventions by Hugh Watkins, inspired by The Sibling Solution by Rhett Griffiths and commissioned by him for his sister Sarah. We've just heard it performed by the composer. Now, Hugh, the kinds of pieces we're hearing in this composer portrait, solo piano, chamber music, how do they relate to the bigger pieces, the orchestral work, something like the violin concerto tonight? What sort of things would we recognise in the violin concerto from your chamber music?
That's a good question. I hope you will recognise something. It's difficult for me to step outside my own language and say exactly what you will recognise, but I think the thing about composing is that however hard you try to be somebody else, you end up sounding like yourself. So I can't really answer that very helpfully, I think, but I'm sure you'll recognise things.
And with Alina Ibrahimova, we've got a soloist in the violin concerto with whom you can identify quite strongly. You wrote a partita for her earlier solo violin piece. Were you writing very much with her sound and the way in which she plays the instrument in mind?
Very, very much so. We've done a few concerts together as well. And the thing about Alina, she has this amazing knack of finding exactly the right sound for very wonderfully. And she changes and captures exactly what the music, I think, needs very quickly. And not only that, she's got a sensational technique. I've just come over from listening to the rehearsal, and she's really going for it. It's amazing playing. So, I knew from the experience with a solo piece that you could write anything, however difficult, and she'd just have no problem.
And this, again, we're talking about the way in which you can identify with an individual who's going to perform it, the same with your brother Paul, same with members of the Nash Ensemble.
Exactly.
But if you don't have that, difficult do you find it to actually write something which is more abstract because it doesn't have that character, that personality?
I think with the violin concerto, there are two things that you're writing. You're thinking of Alina's character, and also you're thinking of the character of the violin, which has an enormous character and repertoire and history and all of that. And very often the instrument itself can have as much a character as the performer. So it's a luxury and an inspiration for a composer, I think, to have both, to have a particular performer and an instrument.
And what about other kinds of extra musical inspiration? Because the last piece we're going to hear in this composer portrait is Sad Steps, the string sextet and piano from 2008. Now, let's get behind the title, first of all. Is it the Larkin poem?
It is the Larkin poem. I mean, I like to keep my cards quite close to my chest with extra musical inspiration, but I'm sure lots of you perhaps know that poem anyway, and you can certainly go and look it up. I won't quote it now. It's quite a bleak poem, actually.
Is the poet coming back from? Well, he's been on a visit to the end of the corridor at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he glimpses
exactly
the moon through the curtains.
Yeah,
doesn't he?
It goes from something very sort of everyday, and he thinks he's getting old, and he's thinking about being in love and how it won't come again for him. So it's very sad, and it's certainly another piece. I just liked the idea of a sequence of the steps, a sequence of sort of slow dances, really, with a kind of nocturnal element to it.
And do the sections of the piece actually relate to the passages of the verses of the poem?
No. I mean, the first line, as you know, is groping back to bed after a piss, which I'm not... I didn't think I wanted to musically illustrate that.
This could
Can we say that on Radio 3? I'm not sure. Because I don't think it's... Music, for me, can't do that, you know, word by word, line by line.
On the other hand,
there were
patches of relative coldness and warmth, depending on whether you switch on the vibrato or not, and you're quite specific about instructing the string
players. Yeah, there's some very cold, desolate sounds from the strings. It's great to write for six-stringed instruments, and piano, and then some very warm, nostalgic, pining, rich sounds as well, I think.
What about the physical steps? Because the intervals in the various instrumental parts do change quite strikingly, and eventually they all get sort of crushed together in chords at the climax of the piece.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, right at the end of the piece, all six string players play a single note together, which is quite a sound, actually, all six of them. I think the steps, though, it's more with the rhythm, actually, rather than intervals. There's a kind of lilting saraband-like feel, a slightly skewed 5/8 saraband at the beginning, and various other sort of steps.
And right at the end, you feel, well, going back to the poem, nothing really has changed. You get those sort of, it's a lament at the end, isn't it? There's sad drooping semitones and
absolutely.
The poet is saying that he's talking about the strength and pain of being young and knowing that it can't come again.
I know, it's awful, isn't it?
Well, on that note, well, in this performance of Sad Steps we're about to hear, Hugh plays the piano part himself again with performers from the Royal College of Music, so please welcome them.
Thank you.
Sad Steps by Hugh Watkins, performed for the first time at the Proms Chamber Music Concert 2 years ago. We just heard it played by the composer with a string sextet from the Royal College of Music, violinists Carice Jensen and Anna Blackmer, viola players Rebecca Dyson and Jessica Tickle, cellists Ariana Kasheffi and Colin Clark. And with Hugh's reaction to Philip Larkin's Lament for Lost Youth, that's where we end this composer portrait. I hope you'll join me for the next one in 2 days' time. It's a chance to meet James Dillon as his piece La Navette has its UK premiere in Thursday's Prom. Thanks to all our young performers from the Royal College of Music, to the College for having us, to our audience here in the concert hall, but most of all, though, thanks to Hugh Watkins for joining us, sharing with us his thoughts, his music, and his piano playing.
And that Proms composer portrait was presented by Andrew McGregor. BBC Radio 3, it's 10:15. Well, coming up at 11:45, Fiona Talkington introduces tonight's Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall in London, here's Martin Handley with the second of this evening's Proms.
Good evening. Radio 3. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for the second celebration today at the BBC Proms of Arvo Pärt's 75th birthday, which falls next month. His declaration of Christian faith in the Credo he wrote at the end of the 60s caused that piece to be banned in an Estonia under the Soviet yoke. Pärt withdrew from this hostility and largely stopped composing while he delved first into the music of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and then even further back to plain chant and to the most fundamental elements of music. What he discovered was just how important the basic triad chord of three notes was to his thinking, and how much he felt could be conveyed within a single note. Pärt said, "I've discovered that it's enough when a single note is beautifully played. This one note, or a silent beat, or a moment of silence, comforts me. I work with very few elements, with one voice, two voices. I build with primitive materials, with the triad, with one specific tonality. The three notes of a triad are like little bells, and that's why I call it tintinnabuli." Pärt began writing music using this technique in the mid-70s, and in 1980 he and his family left Estonia, settling in Berlin, and it was there he wrote the St. John Passion we hear tonight. For each of his works adhering to the principles of tintinnabuli, Pärt devises a new set of laws which govern each pitch, every duration, even the structure of the piece. In his vocal music, he's led by the richness of the text, saying he tries to find what is behind every word. It's a very different approach from the dramatic versions of Bach onward. In his lack of word painting and mood setting, Pärt's passion has a neutrality which harks back to very early settings and gives the words their own strength without interpreting them in any way. What we hear is really an intoned ritual. There are two solo voices, Christ, who is always accompanied by the organ, as at a faster tempo is Pilate. A quartet of four voices sings the evangelist's narrative with the remaining four instruments, violin, oboe, cello, and bassoon. The chorus takes all the other roles and plays the mob. Pärt's Latin setting has a unique abstract timelessness, and his structure gives the passion a power you can only grasp by hearing the whole work. The BBC singers, the instrumentalists of Endymion, and the organist Ian Farrington are already on stage. So now please welcome the tenor Andrew Kennedy, who sings Pilate, the bass Brindley Sherratt, who sings Jesus, the quartet, who sing the evangelist, Michaela Haslam, David Alsop, Stephen Jeffs, and Stephen Charlesworth, and conductor David Hill, to perform Arvo Pärt's St. John Passion.
discipulis suis trans torrentem cedrum, ubi erat ortus, in quem introibit ipse, et discipuli eius. Si ebat autem et Judas, qui tradebat eum, frequenter Jesus convenerat illuc cum discipuli suis. Judas ergo cum acceptis et laternis et facibus et armis. Yeah.
Judah.